Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What drove James Brown to soar beyond the horrors of his desperately impoverished childhood to leave an indelible mark on American music? And why was he never fully able to banish his demons? Born in 1933 and raised in the Jim Crow South, Brown suffered abuse and abandonment as a boy, but discovered his gift for music early in life. By his early 20s, he was touring with his own band and a few years later sold a million copies of his first record. Brown's extraordinary work ethic and outsized ego helped make him a dazzling performer and international superstar, even as he struggled with a raging temper and an addictive personality. Author R.J. Smith tells Brown's remarkable story in his new biography, The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. R.J., welcome to Think.
Chris, great to talk to you. Good afternoon.
You actually start this story with a history that begins in the 18th century. Talk about why you felt it was so important to give us as readers a sense of the place that gave birth to James Brown.
Well, I think that there are so many ties from Africa to modern day in black music, in the culture that embodied James Brown. And I really wanted to trace him back to slavery and to talk about the place from which he came.
And for all his troubles, Brown really remained throughout his life quite dedicated to the town of Augusta.
That's the amazing thing. Part of it is that I think Augusta kept telling James Brown to leave, and he was a very stubborn guy, and when they told him that, he dug down and stayed even longer. Of course, he loved the place, truly, as well. It was the place that he wasn't born there, but he grew up there, and he always kept coming back. He was a Southerner, and he felt at home there.
Now, his life as a child was just like the stuff of Dickens. His father, in particular, was incredibly volatile.
He was a very violent guy and was there sometimes for James and often wasn't. Yeah, Brown was mostly raised on the streets of Augusta. He lived in a house run by an aunt. It was a house of ill repute. Mm-hmm. They sold bootleg whiskey there. Brown had to take care of himself, and he learned a lot of good and a lot of bad lessons from that.
Were you able to see, did he witness a lot of violence against women while he was living in the brothel?
Well, I don't know specifics, but inevitably he certainly did. Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that that shaped his sense of women, mm-hmm. his respect for women or lack of respect for women. It certainly shaped his relationships.
What sort of musical climate existed in Augusta in the 1930s and 40s?
Well, there was music everywhere. Augusta then and down to this day is kind of celebrated as a great gospel town. There's a lot of great harmony singing that goes on there. And Brown heard it. He went to a number of different churches, didn't belong to a particular one, went to a lot of them. And he just heard, there were street preachers and street singers in Augusta. So from a very early age, he was hearing harmony singing, in the barbershops, in the places that he hung out in the corners. On the radio, there was gospel. A famous group, the Suwanee Quartet, was from Augusta, still singing today. Brown heard it all.
And he realized pretty early on that he could sing, and other people recognized that too.
Yes, I think, he had such, he didn't have any control over his life. He couldn't provide for himself. He was sent home from school for what they called insufficient clothing. He wore burlap sacks. And from singing and dancing at an early age, I think he realized or learned that this was a way he could get some control and get a positive feedback from people.
But even as he's, going around and winning contests and getting accolades for this, he was also getting into trouble, at least a little bit of trouble with the law.
Absolutely. From the start, I think there was an adversarial relationship there. His first bout of trouble came when he was a teenager, and it was for breaking into cars on the street of Broad Street, the main drag in Augusta. He stole suits and some clothes out of cars to wear, mm-hmm. and that caught up with him, and he went to jail for a number of years.
Do you think his small size played any role in the development of that really aggressive personality?
Definitely. Definitely. I think he embodies that idea of the small guy syndrome, the Napoleon syndrome. I think people always talked about how you didn't even have to be looking at him when he walked in the room. You just sensed his presence. He filled up the space when he entered the room, and you knew it. And that's part of it. He just knew how to telegraph his existence, and definitely, for good and bad, he wanted to dominate the space around him and declare himself, and he did it in all kinds of ways.
So tell us about his first band, The Flames, and how they came together.
Yeah, he went to prison in Augusta, well, in Georgia, rather, for a few years, and when he came out, the order was that he had to live with a family in the town surrounding where the prison was, a small town in the northern Georgia called Toccoa. Of course, part of the agreement to release him was that he would not go back to Augusta for basically about 10 years, I think it was. So he lived in Toccoa, a small mountain town, couldn't be more different from Augusta, much calmer, race relations better, cooler. And he lives with a family, the Bird family. Bobby Bird was a terrific singer himself, a great keyboard player, and a very mellow, gentle soul. And Bobby Bird and Brown hit it off when they first met. Bird played for the town team. They were playing softball at the prison that Brown was in. And they met that way, and they hit it off. And Bird said, "Hey, you can come live with me if you can get out." And that's how it all began.
And we're about to listen to their first big breakout hit. It was Please, Please, Please. We'll listen to it now, and then we'll talk about it.
Sure.
Please, 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 please.
That is James Brown, Please, 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 a hit in 1956. Is that right, RJ?
That's right.
Obviously, we hear a lot of gospel in that track. How was it different from other records that were successful at the time?
Well, musically and kind of structurally, it's not so different. It's a familiar, recognizable form and style. The group, The Flames, was Bobby Bird's group, and Brown was invited into that, and pretty soon, of course, it became Brown and the Flames with mm-hmm. Bobby Bird. And I think what makes it different is that over-the-top singing, that intense repetition
yeah.
of pleas, and the pleading, begging style that just really pushed it to the periphery.
Did it take him a while to get to singing that way? I mean, are earlier recordings that didn't quite hit, do they sound different?
Well, that's the first recording we have of James Brown. There's always been this rumor or legend that there's an earlier single that was recorded for a small label in Georgia that might be some gospel music, but no one's ever actually come up with it. So that's the first thing. And I think that he always had that intense shouting style that even as a teenager, he got it from some rhythm and blues, a great singer named Louis Jordan, who had a much calmer vocal style but an intense music style, and from the church, where shouters and exclaimers were in the front row.
So it was this big break for James Brown that Little Richard left the road for a while and tapped Brown to fill out those concert dates.
Well, Richard, who wasn't quite a star at the time they first met, was playing a show in Toccoa, and if he had been a star, he never would have played in a town like that. It was so small. But he was playing there, and the Flames, who were even smaller on the horizon at that point, were attending as fans or listeners. I don't know if they were fans, if they even knew who he was, but he was the entertainment in town that night. So they went, and Brown asked Little Richard, "Can I come up, or can my group come up on the stage and play with you?" And Richard said, "Well, I don't really, he knew better than to do that with anybody." But he invited them to play when he took his break, and he liked what he heard, and he said, here's my manager's number. You should really call him. And so they ended up sharing a manager, and all living together, not together, but in the same town of Macon, Georgia, shortly after in the early 50s. And then Richard hits big. He becomes a huge star, moves to California, and he leaves that manager with all these unfinished tour dates. So James Brown knew the show, knew the style. He didn't really look like Little Richard at all, you know, but he needed a job. And so the manager said, listen, we've got all these dates. You're going to be Little Richard. And he went out there, and, you know, about half the set would be James Brown imitating Little Richard, and then he just couldn't take it anymore. He had to be James Brown, and he tried to make the audience not care that he wasn't really Little Richard.
And it would sometimes take them a while to realize, at least in the beginning, that it wasn't Little Richard on stage.
Yeah, because Richard was, you know, he was starting to be heard on the radio, but not a lot of people knew what he looked like yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was some confusion there, and Brown made the most of it. Of course, another thing that he got from Little Richard, besides a lot of musical advice and a manager and so forth, was the hair.
The hair, yeah.
We talked about him being having that short man syndrome. Well, the hair, whatever else it did, it also added, you know, a good 5-6 inches to his frame and helped him out when he entered the room. You know, he said he didn't want people to say, where is he? He wanted people to say, there is he.
And there's no coincidence that the future Reverend Al Sharpton had a similar hairstyle.
That is no coincidence at all. Later on in the story, when Brown takes young Alfred Sharpton under his wing, he says, listen, I will make you a star. It's almost like a storybook kind of thing where he says, I'll make you a star, I promise you that, but you have to promise me something. As long as I live, you do the hair the way I say you do it, and you never change it. And both things happened.
And it was a big deal. It wasn't just the hair. For James Brown, his appearance from a certain point in his career, he always wanted to look like someone, I think his phrase was, someone that people would pay money to see.
Yes, yes. Hair and teeth, he said. If a man had those two things, he had it all. And he was very self-conscious. He wasn't a traditionally handsome sort of standard out of the catalog guy, and the other guys in the band at first were they got the women more than he did, and that really bothered him along with his height. He practiced, you know, he had his teeth done and his hair done 3 times a day. He really was obsessive about that stuff.
What kinds of costumes did he wear early on before he fully came into his own?
Well, the circuit that he was performing on, the so-called Chitlin' Circuit, was like most of all, you know, small. It could be pool halls and tobacco barns and swimming, you know, community swimming pools that were drained out and they had a little stage at the deep end. Whatever worked, and the people that went there were working African Americans who this might be the one show they see that week or that month,
mm-hmm.
and they really needed to be entertained. And Brown and the band wore these really over-the-top, garish, unhip, as they would say, in more fancy places. You know, one set of clothes they had, I think, was green on one half and orange on the other half. And they all wore them as a group.
My guest is author R.J. Smith. We're talking about his new biography. It's called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 8th. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
I feel good.
knew that I would not. So good, so good, I got a year. A sugar and spine. I feel nice. A sugar and spine. So nice, so nice. I got you.
James Brown, of course, singing I Got You. My guest this hour is author R.J. Smith. His new book is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. RJ, you certainly take pains to give credit to the contributions of various band members over the years who collaborated with James Brown. Their musical gifts are extraordinary, but it seems like they deserve the most credit for sticking around with this guy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they should get a book of their own. And the Flames are just getting, as a group unto themselves, are getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, which is kind of cool. But, yeah, I mean, if you traveled and were in his band, you were one of the great musicians in the field. Brown liked, you know, powerful, educated, talented musicians. They could read and write music. Many of them, he couldn't. But at the same time, if you wanted to be a star or get your name on a record or make a lot of money, you probably weren't going to do that playing in a James Brown band. It was his show. He was the guy and the boss. And, yeah, he fined people in his band for all kinds of stuff.
Let me repeat that for people who didn't get it. Fined, he would charge them fines.
He would. If you watch, if you go, like, look at YouTube clips of him doing live shows or songs from the stage, and you start looking for it, you see him when he's moving around and twirling, and he's flashing fingers. And what that is five fingers is $25, 10 fingers is $50. He's looking at certain musicians and telling them how much he's fining them. It could be because their shoes weren't shined, or he would be inspecting from the stage in the middle of a song if you had Vaseline on your shoes because you didn't have time to get them shined properly. A drop beat or a bad note or something. He noticed everything, and he was keeping a record of it.
And he was physically violent with them on occasion.
He was. He was a boxer as a teenager in Augusta, a not half bad one, I'm told, and thought about that as a career for a while. And yet he fought his way to the front of that band. It was a group of musicians originally, and he became the front man by power of talent and by power of fist. And yeah, he used his fist to get his way with the musicians.
I have to tell you, I mean, as much as you come to admire James Brown and how hard he works reading this history, knowing the way he treated women in particular makes it a little bit hard for me to embrace him uncritically.
Yes, yes, I understand that. Well, I think what I hope to do is with this book, The One, is to show people that he was a human being and that there are reasons that he did everything that he did that are rooted in his story, the music and the talent and the genius for moving audiences comes from his story, and the violence and the addiction, that's part of it too. But there's not justification per se for it, but we need to understand it. And I think later on in his life he became kind of a butt of so many jokes to people and late-night talk show hosts and Saturday Night Live or whatever. And he kind of ended up, later on in his life, being looked at as less than human by some people, as this kind of this object of farce and not quite a human being. And I just want to make sure people understand this was a person in all respects.
How did the incident with Tammy Terrell not just destroy his career?
Yeah. In the book, there are a number of incidents of violence I talk about, and you know, Tammy Terrell, before she became the superstar on Motown, was in his show, a singer and dating James Brown. He beat her, and there's a scene where he uses a hammer. Somebody told me on Tammy, and all I can why did that not? Yes, I suspect two main reasons. One is he had folks around him that were paid you know, paid for them good money to protect him from, protect the story from getting out, and paying her to keep it from getting out and so on. And I suppose as well, you know, the fact that he was on the black end of the showbiz world, that people, you know, that there weren't all these reporters following him around, I don't think people cared as much. I don't think law enforcement or the entertainment press, you know, I don't think they're watching that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is author R.J. Smith. His new book is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Beth in Dallas. Hey, Beth.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Smith. He has a nickname, James Brown had a nickname of the Godfather of Soul. And I was wondering how he got that name and maybe when he got it.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, I'm not a doctor. I guess I'm tempted to say only play one on TV, but I don't even play one on TV. No, but thank you for that question. He did the soundtrack for a movie called Black Caesar in the mid '70s, in the so-called blaxploitation era of inexpensive high action dramas, you know, like Shaft and whatever. And in Black Caesar, the poster for that movie, the slogan was, Hail Caesar, Godfather of Crime or something. And Brown liked that. And somebody that was working with him and who's still alive said, you know, started using that as the introductory, one of the many accolades, of course, that got shouted during his introduction. He was this. He was Butane James, the hardest working man in show business, and the Godfather of Soul. Of course, the Godfather was big at that time, too. So all these things are coming together. Brown knew a good slogan when he heard it, and he took it.
We have an email here from Sam who writes, in the movie Soul to Soul, Wilson Pickett got James Brown's accolades, and you see that the music and dance of the Northern Ghanaians as the root of soul music is featured in that movie. Do you know why James Brown was not in the group of musicians that went from the U.S. to Ghana for that concert?
I do not. That's an excellent question. I don't know. I know that Africa mattered to Brown a lot more than he was comfortable talking about. He loved all audiences. He especially loved the acclaim and the respect that he got in Africa. And he always loved to play there. And I think that he part of it, I don't know, but I'm guesstimating that Brown didn't like to do things with groups of other musicians. He wanted to be the musician. So if it was his act going to a place and getting having the film crew follow him around, he loved that. But if he was going to be one of the guys in a group of great musicians, then he wasn't so inclined to go that way.
So, R.J., James Brown had a connection to Africa. He certainly was proud of his race, and yet he had sort of, there was a checkered perception of how he felt about being black and how he felt about white America and his place in overall America. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. And that's definitely one big part of my book, The One, that I really want people to be aware of and take a look at. He really wanted to matter to people in a lot of different ways. He had a lot of strong feelings about what was going on in the country, and they weren't, you know, I suspect people's politics and feelings about all kinds of things are a lot more complicated and not as cookie-cutter as they sometimes are presented in the media. And Brown, for instance, he felt very strongly about the civil rights movement, but in a very fascinating way, he was critical of Dr. King in that, although he supported him and praised him, he was not, no surprise, James Brown was not a believer in nonviolence, and he felt that you had to fight, or that he had to fight, that African Americans had to fight for their rights in any way possible, and you couldn't count on peaceful methods to get your rights. But at the same time, he was really critical of the Panthers and various nationalist groups, because to Brown, he felt that the engine of change would be enterprise and business in the black community. He felt that putting money in people's pockets was going to empower them more than anything else, more than trying to separate from larger society or to build a nation or something of one's own. He felt that you had to be a part of bigger society and have power in it to make decisions that would come from business.
How did the song America Is My Home reflect that sensibility?
Wow. Yeah, he recorded that and then didn't release it for about a year. In 67 and 68 it came out. And it's a ballad. It's almost the way he sings it, almost a rap song, almost a talking lyric song. And he is, to my mind, being pretty critical of the Vietnam War protesters. He loved his country in his way, that not that the protesters didn't, but he questioned them on that level. To him, protest could be a sign of disrespect to the country. And so he crafted this message that almost, to me, sounds more like a country ballad, something like Okie from Muskogee or something, than it does a rhythm and blues song that was praising America at a time when there weren't many songs on the pop charts that were doing that.
Talking about me leaving America, you got to be crazy. Man, I like all the nice things, Jack. Continental suits and things. Look here. Now, I'm sorry for the man who don't love this land. Now, black and white, they may fight. But if the enemy come, we'll get together and run them out of sight. Now, look here. The sun don't come out in rainy weather. But when you boil it down, they are still together. Now, let's not overlook the fact that we're still in reach. You got a chance to make it, and you got a freedom of speech. Say what you wanna.
So, RJ, I have to tell you, I had heard in the past, and your book confirmed that it was true, that James Brown endorsed Richard Nixon. I did not expect to learn that he was close personal friends with Strom Thurmond.
Yes, yes, that's a real head-scratcher, isn't it? Of course, Strom Thurmond, arch-segregationist senator from South Carolina. And Brown certainly, well, he definitely did not endorse or support segregation, but he always, I think, wondered if the races were ever going to get along and could be pretty fatalistic about that. But I asked a lot of people and thought about that as much as any part of the book, because a lot of people told me, I've seen photos on the Strom Thurmond Institute of Brown and Thurmond having a nice visit on a Easter Sunday at Thurmond's place in the country, and you know, they look like a couple of guys just sitting on the porch, kicking back and talking about whatever. And I think that's the level that they kind of connected on. They came from the very same part of South Carolina, those two guys did. Their families apparently knew each other. I think there was something about a sense of Southern familiarity that brought them together. Now, at the same time, and, you know, they made appearances together and attended parties for each other, and Thurmond was somewhat supportive of Brown when he was again in prison later on in his life. I think there's also obviously a level of calculation there. It behooved Thurmond to have some powerful African-American friends from or around South Carolina, and it helped Brown out, I'm sure, in all kinds of ways to have a powerful white friend in Washington.
And, of course, as we will hear now, Brown had no problem expressing once again his pride in exactly who he was. Say It Loud, I'm Black and Proud by James Brown. RJ, was that song played everywhere?
Well, yes and no. it was played everywhere. I think it had one of its debuts was in Texas, as I recall, and was recorded there early on a live recording. And I think that it was a hit. It was a national and international hit. So on that level, it was hard to go to a place and not hear it on AM radio. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it really, you know, at this moment, not long before, he'd finally really had almost a 50-50 split, white, black, in his audiences. Then this record comes out that, you know, I think the most of us today, and a lot of us even then, perhaps, you know, was an expression of pride, of self-love, but was perceived by white radio programmers and some in the record industry as this dangerous message of, I mean, there was so much fear in the air, I guess, and rioting in the streets. That song came to embody a lot of people's fears. So white radio stops playing him from that moment on, and that was the last big hit he had until Living in America many years later.
I mean, that must have been a devastating moment for him when he had just been building and building and building.
Absolutely. And the fascinating thing about Brown to me, one of the many fascinating things, he wanted everybody to love him. He wanted, you know, he wanted huge audiences like any pop star would, but he really, really craved them. But at the same time, he always did it on his terms. He didn't think there was anything wrong about putting out a song, America Is My Home, and following it up with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. He wanted to do what he wanted to do, and he felt that if he could get it out there, people would love it. And he was shocked when people stopped loving it, at least some parts of the audience, after that record.
My guest is author R.J. Smith. His new book is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 8th. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know. Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene. Machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm. Stay on the scene. I like a sex machine. You got to have the feet.
James Brown singing Get Up. I feel like being a sex machine. That might be one of those sentences, RJ, that I never imagined myself saying on the air. RJ Smith is my guest. He's the author of a new biography called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. We'll go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Kenneth waiting patiently on the line in East Dallas. Hey, Kenneth.
Hello. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for my call. I was curious about when the bassist William Collins played with him.
Yeah. When Bootsy Collins played with him. Yeah, yeah. That was an amazing... I'm going to ramble on, but if you had more to ask, please jump in. But, yeah, Bootsy Collins and his brother Catfish Collins and a whole bunch of other musicians from Cincinnati all come in 1970 to the Brown Band. And the band that was with him, it's an amazing story where the band wanted more money. They were tired of, you know, the treatment they were getting, and they had a mass rebellion. And they gave him a letter, you know, of almost like a union might, and said, you need to change or we're going to leave. And Brown kind of strung him along. He had this group of musicians from Cincinnati, kids, that he'd watched in the studio a little bit. And he kind of quietly called Cincinnati and said, get them on my jet, bring them here tonight. They were playing in Columbia, Georgia, and so the night of a show, as the audience is chanting, "Where's James? Where's James?" Basically, Collins and all the Cincinnati guys come into the auditorium. They'd never played with Brown before. They knew the Live at the Apollo show, and suddenly they're on stage with their idol, who's just fired the band that used to play with him, and it's sink or swim time. And as I'm sure your caller knows, those guys were brilliant musicians, and they challenged James Brown. They changed the whole sound of the band. They made him young again, really.
Talk about it. It's really remarkable how long he was able to keep up the physical demands of his act. And as you remind us, that at the peak of his career, he was playing like 330 shows a year.
It's a crazy, yeah. And some of those shows, on a day when there's one show, he's playing 3.5 hour long shows.
Wow.
In the theater circuit, he might be doing 5 shows a day that weren't that long, but, an hour to 2 hour shows. It was just an amazing, today, incomprehensible kind of thing that he was doing. He was always about work. There's definitely a Booker T. Washington, take care of yourself, no one else can do it kind of thing to what he's doing. And as well, he just didn't take it for granted, ever. He really, as proud and boastful and self-confident in all kinds of ways that he seemed to people, he really was afraid that it could all go away, that he wasn't going to be talented and the audience wasn't going to like him tomorrow night unless he got out there and proved it to everybody.
It's a strange comparison to draw, but there have been, recent documentaries featuring the comedian Joan Rivers, and it's almost the same story for her.
There is something about great entertainers that that's part of, you think of the life being, of being on the outside of it, of being so, man, I'd love to do that, and it must be pure enjoyment. And there are times, I'm sure, when they, at least the ones that survive, definitely are enjoying themselves. We don't feel bad for them in a lot of times, but it's a grueling, tough, I bet you the amount of work for all the maybe money or whatever they end up with, the amount of work that a performer like James Brown or Michael Jackson or Bob Hope or Joan Rivers, the amount of work they put in to get where they are, it's almost, there are probably better ways to get there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Gary on the line next in Plano. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon. I saw James Brown perform some years back in, a concert, and I was really surprised when he got on the Hammond B3 organ and spent so much time on it, because at the time, my question is, did he see himself as a frustrated keyboard artist or something? I didn't think he was that good on it, but he sure spent a lot of time during his concert.
Yeah, he loved to play the organ. He loved keyboards. That was the first instrument he learned, was the piano and then the organ. And, there was a part of him that felt he could do everything. And he loved to play the drums, too, sometimes. And, he's definitely a better drummer than I am. But he was by far the worst drummer that ever played with the James Brown band. And as far as the organ goes, yeah, it's something. He felt comfortable there, and he liked the sound, and he liked that vibe. He made some records that are quite good on the organ, not technically good necessarily, or not like a Jimmy Smith or somebody, but just have a really nice feeling to them. But, yeah, I've heard that, too, that he could kind of get, sometimes when he sat down at the organ on stage, he might be there a half hour.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Wilton on the line in Plano. Hello, Wilton.
How you doing?
Very well,
yeah,
thanks.
No, I just wanted to make a comment on, if you look at James Brown and you look at the struggle that he had internally within himself to fit in, especially to fit in white society, you can see how he self-medicated himself. But, the genius was still there. And you compare him to Whitney Houston, Bobby Brown, Chris Brown today, and you look at how society looks upon black artists and entertainers, you can just tell the struggle that he had in him trying to find himself, you know, everything that he went through. Yeah, it was a lot of up and down, but he gave so much of himself. That's all I just wanted to say.
Thanks for your call, Wilton. Do you want to respond to that, RJ?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a brilliant, important thing, and I'm glad William said that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of many revelations to me that I discovered, you know, in writing the one, and it's a story that it's there in the book, is, you know, James Brown called himself at various interviews, various parts of his life, he referred to himself as a slave. And I just thought, wow, I'm not even sure I know all the things he meant when he talked about himself that way, but to a certain point, I get it, and I know what he's talking about, and some of it's exactly what William's talking about, I think. And that's one more reason why I hope I didn't go on too long at the beginning of the book, but I really start the book in the slavery times because some of the problems that begin there are still with us today.
He was not, RJ, one of these superstar musicians who bounces in and out of rehab. He sort of struggled with drugs his entire life, but didn't really acknowledge that they were a problem in his life.
That's right. He was a prideful, prideful man. And he was never going to, he never thought he could count on anybody else for anything. And his whole life lesson was to do for himself. And so the idea of laying down your pride and surrendering and asking for help was just, he just could not go there. And he would deny, pretend that he had it under control or that it wasn't a problem until, you know, law enforcement or family or his manager or all the above said, no, it's a problem.
Let's speak on the phones next with Chris in Arlington. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing? I have a real quick question. I'll take my answer off the air, but I wanted to know, with the drummers coming up with things, like, for example, this is a perfect example. I've heard both sides of the argument. Who gets the right to, like, for example, a track like Funky Drummer that's still even used today? By musicians.
Ah, yeah. Now, the Funky Drummer is one of the most sampled pieces of music in hip-hop history. And particularly, it's a great drum solo that Clyde Stubblefield, a man who's very much with us today, he's got some kidney problems, played. And I'd have to check, but I don't think James gave... You know, James wrote the song. I think on the song, that's what it will say on the record. And I don't know that he gave Clyde any particular remunification for that hit when it came out. And I don't know to this day that I think some people being nice to Clyde maybe sometimes when they sample him, write him a check. I know many, many more times people don't write him a check when they sample his music. And if they have to pay anybody, it's the person whose name is on that record. And I believe that person's name is James Brown or his estate. So, yeah, it's one of the most famous James Brown pieces of music. And the guy who was the engine of it, one of the guys, Clyde Stubblefield, you know, never got what he was due.
How long were you working on this book, RJ, before it was published?
Oh, four-plus years and... I could be working on it now.
Do you think James Brown would have been happy to talk to you?
I think two things. I think he would have been happy to talk to me because he was happy to talk to anybody on his terms.
Uh-huh.
To sell a show when he was coming to your town, he loved to talk. To sell a record, he there's a lot of interviews with James Brown, but I don't think he would have been happy to answer or entertain a lot of the questions I needed answered for this book, and it might have been a harder book to write. I wish he was with us. It would have been a harder book to write if he was.
It has to have been challenging for you when you spoke to a lot of these guys he had played with over the years who were getting up in age themselves, when you would get multiple versions of the same story and have to figure out which one was closest to what actually happened.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And you know something, James Brown... and I hope this comes across in the one. He was somebody that when he hooked up with you, it was for one, you know, he was thinking about what he wanted. He showed you one little side of himself, and you remember that side. And you've got a great story about that side. But then the next guy in the band or in his life has a whole contrary picture of him. He was many different people to those around him, and nobody knew the whole thing about him, I don't think. So yeah, well, you have to fact check these things. You have to be as accurate as you can make it, and try to be absolutely fair to people. Sometimes a story is impossible to check. It's a good story that isn't, that just says. Sometimes there's stories that say things about a person. Almost in a way of a fable or something. They get at a greater truth, and you don't necessarily know the day or the week or the month that it happened on.
What kind of groundwork did James Brown lay for the music that's popular today?
Well, I would say a huge amount of groundwork. You hear his vocal style sometimes on things like American Idol. You hear him on Michael Jackson. You see him in Michael Jackson's performances. I think Michael Jackson was in many ways his greatest disciple. You know, you hear him in the cadences of Reverend Al Sharpton today, for that matter. I think whenever you see a great performer who kind of has a 360-degree representation of themselves, singers, dancers, great communicators, those are the people that are tapping the tradition of James Brown.
It's got to be hard to move on after you have so closely studied such a gigantic personality.
I still have him in my head. Yeah, I still think about him, and, I'm never not going to be. I think he was one of a kind and as great a musician as has lived in my lifetime. So I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I'm starting to think about it.
You didn't get
if you got any ideas, I'd love to hear them.
You never got tired of the music? You know how you'll listen to a CD too many times?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I grew up in Detroit, Motown.
Yeah.
And I still love all that Motown stuff, but I feel like I'm not tired of it, but I don't feel like it grows on me, that I know it and I know what to expect, and it makes me feel good, but it's kind of closed or finished or something. But there's so much in the best James Brown music and those 70s funk grooves and the soul music, and he left so much music, and it's so open and alive, and it's because of the rhythm that one doesn't get tired of.
R.J. Smith's new biography is called The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. R.J., thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for hearing me. It's nice talking to you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, those go to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.